Greetings to all. Nick DeOlias, this is the Far Middle. Let me start by wishing all the veterans out there a belated yet happy Veterans Day. Thank you for your service. We are often reminded, especially in current times with all the global chaos that's going on out there, that there is nothing free about freedom. You hear that all the time. And yep, that's more true than ever, I'm afraid. Now, with this being episode 78, and it also being the middle of football season, we're going to dedicate the episode to the unsung heroes of the trenches. Those offensive linemen and their adversaries on the defensive line of the ball who dedicate themselves to protecting and enabling the offensive superstars to do great things and who obsess about foiling the offensive plans, respectively. These are the ones who never got the limelight they deserved, who paid the heaviest prices in many instances, and who were noted for keeping their heads down and doing their jobs. Yeomen to be admired. And by the way, the number 78 was one worn by legends of the trenches in NFL lore, both offensive and defensive sides of the ball. Some of the great 78s of NFL history in those trenches, it's sort of a who's who. They include Jackie Slater, right? Jackie Slater's a Hall of Famer on the offensive line. He blocked everyone and everything. And while he was doing that, he made the greats great. And specifically here, I'm talking about Eric Dickerson, who was one of the great running backs in NFL history. You got Bruce Smith. He was a 78. My favorite Virginia Tech Hokie and Bill defensive lineman. He defined that position basically in the 1990s. And he propelled the Bills, of course, to four Super Bowl appearances. And of course, he's a Hall of Famer too. You got Curly Culp for all those old timers out there. Another 78. He played when I was a little kid. I remember him with the Oilers where he first wore the number 78. Defensive lineman that ended up in the Hall of Fame, but also Curly Culp, for those of you who aren't familiar with him, he was an NCAA heavyweight wrestling champion. So great athlete. Unfortunately, he passed away last year. I'm sad to report that. And then another defensive great who wore 78 was Bobby Bell of the Kansas City Chiefs. He was part linebacker and part defensive end. He was no stranger to the trenches of the NFL. And perhaps the greatest of the 78s was Anthony Munoz, the ultimate offensive lineman. If you recall, we dedicated an episode a few weeks ago to the great John Hanna, who I said at the time might be the greatest offensive lineman ever. Might was used because a lot of people consider Munoz to be the greatest. So it's good to get him into a dedication as well. Yeah, those trenches, that's where the unsung heroes toil to allow the stars to shine or not shine, depending on which side of the ball you're fighting in the trenches on. Think of all the legendary quarterbacks and running backs and wide receivers who basically summited greatness by either being helped by the offensive linemen in the trenches or by overcoming those greats prowling the defensive side of the trenches. So episode 78 goes to those in the trenches of the NFL who wore the number 78, greats who made greats or went head-to-head against other greats. Maybe they didn't get the recognition they deserved by fans at the time, but they certainly got it from their peers on the field. So let's get going, making connections in the way the patron saint of the Far Middle, the great Dr. James Burke, did on his BBC series Connections. We started the episode honoring those in the trenches, and trenches used to be the method of choice for sewage systems across civilizations. Now, they were crude, but trenches worked because, well, gravity works. And the problem, of course, was the trenches for removing human waste are not the most hygienic method, and they will create the opportunity for disease to spread. Poor sewage, it killed millions of people through the years until the technologies advanced to where they are today. Heck, maybe hundreds of millions died when you think about it and you add it up over all the years. Now, you and I, we're going to take the modern toilet for granted. They're everywhere and they always work, but maybe we shouldn't take them for granted because these days it seems governments across the land, they're perplexed with how to install the standard toilet in their city or building or park without spending crazy amounts of money and taking years to do it. That's taxpayers' money, by the way, and that's your money, by the way. Now, in San Francisco, which is a city whose dysfunction we discussed numerous times on prior Far Middle podcasts, it's an extreme example of the economics of public toilets in cities these days. Now, what I'm about to tell you, I'm not making this up. This is actually happening. So first, understand that the condition of San Francisco's streets is shocking. And it's a throwback to those hundreds of years ago that I just mentioned, where trenches, or in this case, curbs of streets, They're serving as the main conveyance of human waste due to the breakdown of social order on the streets of San Francisco. So human feces and waste, it's everywhere one walks in numerous neighborhoods. It's creating a definite health crisis. So toilets, and particularly public ones, they're a luxury and a big deal in one of the most powerful cities in the most powerful nation on earth. And this fiasco of the public toilet, it all started when local officials in San Francisco were getting ready to hold a public celebration for a public toilet in a local town square. So by the way, one of the first things I thought of is, what exactly happens at the opening of a public toilet or the commissioning of one? You know, like for a building, there's a ribbon cutting. And for a groundbreaking, there is a symbolic first shovel of dirt or something like that. What do you do here? Is it like a celebratory first flush? I'm not sure. But anyway, when the local newspaper heard about the upcoming event, they did some digging. The journalists did what they used to do and what they're supposed to do and what they don't do enough of these days, which is hold government accountable and bring facts to light. Well, those facts surrounding the planned celebration for the public toilet, they were hard to believe. Turns out a single public toilet at that location in San Francisco is going to cost up to $1.7 million. And it won't be ready due to permitting and bureaucracy delays until 2025. So when the journalist reported these facts, he or she referenced it as mind-boggling. Yeah, I'll second that. And I think that was actually a perfect descriptor of the situation. Now, the politicians that were coming to celebrate this fiasco, they're now turning on it and they're becoming critics. Why are they doing that? Because they know it's an embarrassment and it's a horrible optic. So everybody's talking about how embarrassing this is, but not enough people are talking about why it takes $1.7 million in years to build a single public toilet in San Francisco. Well, the far middle can lay out the root causes for all of you constant listeners, and let's walk through those root causes. So first, the utility in town, Pacific Gas and Electric, it's got a Byzantine maze of approvals and the high cost to go with them to get something like a public toilet hooked up. So why those hoops and their costs? Because the state of California and the Public Utility Commission and the federal government, they heavily regulate utilities like Pacific Gas and Electric, and it makes these utilities put up all these barriers that takes time and money and lots of both. And by the way, much of those rules and those approvals and time, they're all tied to draconian climate policies. It's just another example of how being green is becoming a very, very expensive proposition these days. Then, another root cause, there are construction permits and building codes and wage rules, all of which drive up the costs and delay completion time of these types of projects. So it's either exorbitantly expensive or outright impossible to build anything in California or San Francisco these days, whether it's a housing plan or a single public toilet. And then there is a public hearing or approval process where basically anyone or anything can bring a project to a complete grinding halt. And then to get it approved or moving, again, right, you need to acquiesce to the squeakiest wheels demands. And what's that going to do? That's going to add costs. That's going to add time to the project. So you add all these things up, you can see how cumulatively the absurd becomes the normal, how you land at $1.7 million in years to get a single public toilet built. And these things are brought up to us, the taxpayers, by the bureaucracy, by government, by environmentalists, by corporate graft, by bad energy policies, and so on. All the things that I discuss at length in my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, which, by the way, I will remind you on episode 78, you can order on Amazon.com. Please order the book, give it a read, provide me some feedback. All the proceeds from the sale of the book go to the CNX Foundation Mentorship Academy. Okay, let's connect some more dots. Let's go from the topic of big city public toilet bungling to big city public transportation messes. And we'll go from West Coast to East Coast, and we'll go from San Francisco to the Big Apple. Let's talk about New York City subways and how the subways are seeing rising crime and dropping ridership. That's a powerful and a bad 1-2 punch. One builds on the other, and it becomes a vicious downward spiral. The data are interesting, and the data at the same time are deeply troubling to me when you consider the human impact. So first, there is the issue or topic of violent crime. Killings on the subway in New York City in 2020 to 2022, they exceeded those in the 12 years prior, as in the 12 years cumulatively. Felonies are up over 40% year on year. There is no guarantee of safety at any time of day in the New York City subway systems these days, and that is just a sad fact. Second, there's what's going on with ridership. So ridership is plummeting. 81 million ride the subway in New York City monthly in 2022. Now, that sounds like a lot, and it is a lot. 81 million is a lot, but that's down from 142 million monthly in 2019, which is over a 40%+ drop. So when you couple violent crime exploding with plummeting ridership, it's an ugly picture, as I said, that's being painted for the Big Apple's primary mode of public transport. And just like San Francisco and its health crisis with human waste on the streets, it seems as if the more of taxpayer money the government throws at the problem to supposedly fix it, the worse the problem becomes. You sort of add it to the examples of how government oftentimes makes things worse when it's not held accountable. Now, the topic of public safety and crime, it really brings us to another connection, and it's what I'll tag as the fallacy of be aware of your surroundings. Right? You hear that all the time, of being aware of your surroundings, from politicians and others in our big cities about how to navigate and avoid crime. Right? Pay attention, be smart, don't go here, walk with someone, stay in lighted areas at night, and so on. So I saw this overused soundbite once again on a news clip talking about how Los Angeles, and specifically West Hollywood or WeHo, that neighborhood's crime is up something like 140% year on year, just a huge increase in crime. And the mayor of West Hollywood uttered that oft-used phrase of being aware of your surroundings. But if you really are aware of your surroundings of late in our larger cities, then you're going to reach some straightforward conclusions or decisions. So if you're a New Yorker, you're going to think long and hard about even going down into the subway any day, any time of day. It's become that bad, as we've just discussed. And you can see that just reading any daily version of the New York Post or the New York Times or the Daily News. They're all sort of reporting on this. If you're in Los Angeles, and again, let's take West Hollywood, as we just discussed, you're not going to go out at night to a club or restaurant. And if you do venture to one, you should be worried that you're being watched and potentially set up for a robbery once outside, or maybe a home invasion when you're followed home. It's happening more and more in these trendy neighborhoods and areas of Los Angeles, including happening to reality show celebrities. So the ultimate landing point for many residents on this being aware thing, at least over the long haul, is to decide to move out of that zip code or city, because once you become aware of your surroundings, you realize it's not safe or worth it to live there anymore. But that assumes the person has the means and the job skill sets and the finances to move. You know, what about those who don't? Unfortunately, they're forced to stay and they're forced to endure. And as has always been the case in our national history, the poorest and the most vulnerable, they're the ones that have to endure what all of us would find unacceptable, and they've got to endure it the longest. The poorest pay the steepest price when public institutions and public leaders don't lead and they're not accountable. Yeah, we've talked a lot about different connections regarding government's inability to lead and be accountable to taxpayers and citizens, and then the knock-on effects of those types of trends. And that brings us to the dot to connect to of, well, if government is not focusing on the basics of taxpayers and citizens, then what is government obsessing about? And the attention of bureaucrats and politicians today, it's going to ideology and negotiating or bartering our national interests and leverage to further the chosen or the favored ideology. Now, a big example of this, of course, is at play with what's occurring with climate change policies and all those accords and regulations that go with them. So you see this from our climate czar to Congress, to mayors of our larger cities, to the heads of the EPA and DOE within the regulatory state. You see it with states like California and New York. And you also see it, the biggest example, with the President of the United States himself. Today, the highest levels of our government, or governments as in plural, are negotiating pacts with other nations that promise to benefit the climate in 50 years, but that clearly damage U.S. interests today, and that supports our adversaries today as well. So when we're doing those things, or our leaders are doing those things with respect to those energy and climate policies, is that doing the right thing? Because that's what the left says it is, it's doing the right thing. That's not what I say when you look at the science and the reality of these policies and accords in action. Is it a conflict of interest for those leaders when they're pushing these types of policies and accords? I think it is when you consider how many of these politicians and bureaucrats stand to benefit personally from many of these deals, often at the expense of the interests of America and the United States. Is it a dereliction of duty? Well, you can certainly make such an argument, because when a politician or administrator in the bureaucracy takes the oath, they don't swear allegiance to the climate or to the global community or to a certain atmospheric CO2 level, global average temperature, or sea level in 50 years. What they do commit to, in the case of, say, the presidential oath, is, quote, "I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States," end quote. So you consider the details of climate accords and policies, you're going to often be hard-pressed to see how they further and are consistent with the presidential oath. And then how about this one to consider? Is such behavior becoming or stepping up to the lines of something beyond dereliction of duty, such as treason? Now, that sounds outlandish at first blush, right? The definition of treason is the crime of betraying one's country. But, you know, let's talk about and explore this topic a bit. If a national leader is pushing an accord or a treaty that hurts U.S. interests and benefits our enemy's interests, you have a duty to ask why. And that leader should be willing to account for the answer of why. And if the answer to the why question, if it's bogus or if the answer is a smokescreen, and what really is at play is self-interest of the leader or a political party or a way to further a favored ideology, then such an accord that knowingly hurts us and benefits the enemy, that's a major problem. In fact, it would be a betrayal of one's country's interest, right, per the definition of treason itself. And how many climate accords or treaties or regulations hurt us, hurt our security, hurt our economy, and hurt our citizens, and at the same time benefit, say, China's security, China's economy, and China's interests? How many of these policies and accords betray the American worker and the American consumer and the American taxpayer? This is what is so intriguing about energy security, as we discussed many times. Energy security necessarily equates to national security. And it starts to make you wonder, and we should wonder aloud in a reasoned and level-headed path of public discourse, mind you. And we should be wondering, particularly in a time when entities have quickly been exposed is what I'll call as enemies in friends' clothing. So key adversaries, and namely here I'm talking about Iran and Russia and ultimately China, they're looking more and more to be preparing a war footing for a long battle against us. So there's a lot at stake, thus the rigor and the scrutiny and a discussion on considering how to assess these types of behaviors when it comes to energy and climate policies from our leaders and what that means and what those follow-on effects might be in an increasingly dangerous world, those types of discussions and debates are called for. Now, with all this talk of actions or behaviors from public leaders or entities that might be viewed as less than good, let's hit on the next topic to connect to. Let's discuss how our president is calling out American energy companies for being profitable and basically being, well, un-American. Yet President Biden is making his tour around the nation, particularly he did so right before the midterm elections, calling out U.S. energy companies for not spending more on drilling for oil and natural gas, for not growing supply, and basically for putting too much of its profits towards dividends and share buybacks. He says that puts profits before consumers. So let's break this down as to what is actually happening in the domestic energy industry these days. And constant listeners of the Far Middle, you're going to be familiar with many of these points because we discussed them before. So first, the Biden administration, it takes office, and what does it do? It immediately cancels or halts pipelines being built all across the nation. And it also brings leasing of oil and natural gas rights on public lands to a trickle of what it was. Then the leadership of our nation decides to force energy and climate policies left and right, everywhere you look, down the throats of industry and the public. So you see these climate types of policies hidden or embedded within COVID relief bills. You see it within the Inflation Reduction Act. You see it in regulations from the administrative state. It's in global accords, of course, like the damaging Paris Climate Accord, and on it goes. All of these are designed to boost up weaker alternatives in the energy mix, like wind or solar, and push down the more competitive options like domestic natural gas and oil. Now, all this government intervention, what does it do? It drives down the supply of oil and natural gas, as designed from the get-go, which then drives up the cost of energy and stokes inflation. When these happen, our inept leaders, they do more of the same that caused it, is evidenced by the passage of the aforementioned Inflation Reduction Act. That makes them meaning constricted energy supply, high energy costs, and inflation, that makes them even worse. Now, while the fearless leaders and elites in places like Washington, D.C. are cooking up this dog's breakfast of a policy mess, energy companies are acting rationally because they operate in the real world. And that's a world where you are directly accountable for decisions that you make, and frankly, you're accountable for factors beyond your direct control. The real world dictates a few realities. First, investment in drilling and infrastructure, like pipelines, it's up. So domestic energy companies are doing what they can with more activity and investment to respond to the supply crunch and to cost increases. Second, domestic energy companies would love to drill more and build more pipes, but they can't because the projects won't be approved, the leases won't be granted, and there's no room to transport incremental production in the existing plumbing of our pipeline infrastructure. Again, as designed by those elite experts in places like DC with their policies and regulatory onslaught. So the president is calling for the very thing he made impossible by policy design. That's interestingly ironic, even for a politician. And then third, when you are a business and you have maxed out how much you can invest into the asset base or the activity level of drilling and construction, then your next best alternative is still a good one, which is to return those profits that are left to your owners, in other words, to your shareholders. That's who you work for, and that's who owns the business or the company. And by the way, shareholders are typically, directly or indirectly, people like you and me, as in 401k owners, pensioners, retirees, and run-of-the-mill mom-and-pop investors, basically Main Street. You're returning profits to the true owners and countless investors as a responsible and American thing to do. So, what the heck, Mr. President? Do you understand the basics of business in the free market and private enterprise? Do you realize the impact of the policies and regulatory state you fed and turned loose on the American people? Do you see now you are the cause of the very problems you now complain about and finger others as the perpetrators? And do you see now why you are pleading with the Saudis and they laugh? Why you try to bribe the Iranians and they rebuff? Why you threaten the Russians and they invade? And why you court Venezuela and they insult? Your actions and policies, they're doing great damage to America and the world. Embrace the reality, reverse these damaging energy and climate policies now, and then watch the doers in free market quickly right a ship that is severely listing and dead in the water. All this is serious stuff for sure, constant listeners, in episode 78. But I am bringing episode 78 down the home stretch. Let's end with something fun, something positive, something interesting. And let's go to the world of jazz. We spoke this episode about the state of the New York City subway system. And one of the most famous of jazz tunes is Duke Ellington's Take the A Train, which is a composition, the Duke's most famous score, by the way, about the A Train subway line in New York City. Now, who composed the Take the A Train composition for Ellington? Well, it was a musical genius from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, my hometown. His name was Billy Strayhorn, and he was the mind behind many of Duke Ellington's hits, again, most notable being Take the A-Train. Now, Take the A-Train was composed in the late 30s, 1939, after Duke Ellington offered Strayhorn a job in his band and gave him money to travel from Pittsburgh to New York City. Ellington wrote directions for Strayhorn to get to his house by subway, directions that began with Take the A-Train. The rest, of course, was history. In Pittsburgh lore, when it comes to Billy Strayhorn, it gets even more interesting. He attended Westinghouse High School, which is, by the way, still functioning. And that's the same high school that was later attended by two other giants in the field of jazz, Earl Gardner, and one of my favorites of all time, Ahmad Jamal. So the New York City subway and its riders, yeah, they're going through some tough times, as we've discussed in episode 78. But let's focus on the positive by listening to Take the A-Train and enjoying the genius at work with Duke Ellington and his Pittsburgh genius, Billy Strayhorn. See you on the other side at episode 79. Have a good week, everybody.